You are listening to the Dan Patrick Show on Fox Sports Radio.
I was talking about what happened with the Mets game at the end of the game. Michael Conforto, a walk-off hit by pitch. And what stood out not only from the call that was missed, but the Mets announcers disagreeing with the ump's call in the field. So the Mets announcers, Ron Darling and Keith Hernandez, had this reaction with the walk-off hit by pitch.
This is a strike,
yep.
And he gets hit. Look at that. Oh, you can't do that.
They have totally got
They
got
to bring
here.
It back.
Totally have
yes.
a case.
They're
gonna,
it's he, absolute.
It's he stuck his elbow right into that pitch.
It's going to be strike three.
The umpires are conferring, and let's see.
All right, so that is a little bit longer explanation. Ron Darling, Keith Hernandez. Former major leaguers. Keith is going to join us a little bit later on in the show. Let me start there with Mike Tirico, who joins us from Augusta. We've been talking about Conforto leans in on the pitch. What did you make of that, Mike?
So I always wondered when I did the NBA games, and they, I thought, did a good job of using replay. I always thought when you go to replay and you see that you screwed up a call, how do you feel, right? And that's exactly the case. And I just saw the clip of it on social media, so I didn't see the entirety of it. But what Keith Hernandez and Ron Darling and Gary Cohen were saying is exactly right. If you can go to replay, get it right. That's what we all want at the end of the day. It seems as though replay in every sport has gotten so involved that it's lost any common sensibility to be applied. And there you say, yeah, okay, we're not supposed to look at that. But you know what? He moves his elbow in. It's a strike out. Let's move on. Common sense. It would be nice if we could apply some common sense to stuff a little bit more these days.
But I was also wondering that the umpire can only do so much because of what the rule is, that they can't
right.
they can't rule on intent, that they know they made the wrong call because he did lean in, but they don't have the authority to be able to overturn that.
That's the problem. Here's where I think you can maybe use this a little bit better, because it's not the official right there looking at the replay, making the decision. It's going back to the global headquarters, right? Or it's going back to MLB. MLB can make that decision. You're right there. So add some elasticity to the powers of replay. The league office can say, okay, I know we didn't have line 73 addendum B to replay when the guy puts his armor in the strike zone. But let's make sense of this, and this is the right thing to do. And you know what? At the end of the day, the Mets may have said it doesn't go with line 73, note B, but it's the right thing. Because you could see his postgame soundbite was pretty good. He totally looked like the canary. He ate the canary there. He's just kind of, I kind of leaned in a little bit.
But do you respect him for doing that?
Yes, 1,000%.
Okay.
For saying it or for doing it?
No, for doing it.
For doing it? I hate the fact that the guys with that armor, and we talked about this with Bonds, right? Years ago. It's different. You can crowd the plate in a different way than guys used to. I don't like all that body armor for batters, but that ship has long sailed.
We're talking to Mike Tirico joining us from Augusta. The course play tough intentionally yesterday?
I think that there's two things. It's not really the 20 under par was November. We're not going to let that happen again. I think the U.S. Open for a long time had lived with, we've got to get a score somewhere around even par. I don't think that's been the case with the Masters. You've been here so many times. Think about Sundays. They want those eagle opportunities and those roars. That's what's made the Masters special. So they're not allergic to great scoring. I do think that there's been a desire over the years to keep the distance in check. And look at fast and firm and what it did to the guys who hit it a long way. There were struggles for a lot of them on day one. So I think the defense is remaining on courses, especially this one, to keep relevant. And where it bounced out then, as it felt fair, Justin Rose had an 11-hole stretch where he went 9-under. So it was not U.S. Open impossible. It was playable for great scores and a great day. And Justin Rose had 11 great holes.
How great is DeChambeau for TV?
I think he's great for the sport, which in turn is great for TV. So I want to go back to Bay Hill, the Arnold Palmer tournament, and the sixth hole where he's trying to drive it over the water, 340 yards, right? That scene of people with their cameras videotaping it. And the guy was like 5'6" deep, or a lady. I don't know who it was, but that scene where you get all the arms, it looked like a rock concert, right? And then DeChambeau's like, yeah, I did it, right? I think that's great. So I thought, we talked about this a lot when we were working together when Tiger showed up on the scene. We all thought it would bring minorities to the game. I think what it did was bring athletes to the game. And it brought casual golf fans to the TV, Dan, I think, because anytime Tiger got over a shot, he might do something that you'll talk about for a long time. Like, nobody was saying, I've got to watch the Canadian Open, because when Tiger gets to the bunker, he may hit this sick shot out of a bunker over water and land it this close, right? DeChambeau's the same kind of thing. Like, he's spraying it all over Augusta, but I can't wait to watch. Where is he going to drive it on 13? Is he going to take it over the trees on the left? Is he going to go down where the patrons are on 14? So I think that element is sensational for the sport.
There's a curiosity, but it's got to have a payoff, it feels like. With Tiger, you were watching something that was going to inevitably have a payoff where he was going to win. DeChambeau's a curiosity to me. Until he, you know, he starts winning on a consistent basis where he's, you know, Koepka, you know, Brooks Koepka is a better golfer than DeChambeau, but DeChambeau is more of a curiosity here.
But DeChambeau did win a U.S. Open at a really tough course in Wingfoot, right? So I think that, plus backed up with wins, look, he's won Arnold's tournament. He's won Jack's tournament at the Memorial. He won the U.S. Amateur. So it's not as though it's all the circus show. These played great golf, difficult golf courses, tough events to win. So I think there's a lot of curiosity, but I do think there's enough there that it's not just a sideshow. I think it's really effective. Dan, I spent some time with him in the fall. I think he's as fascinating an athlete, not just a golfer, an athlete, as we have in sports because of his approach. And you talk to him, and it seems like a little mad scientist, but he's thought it all out, and he's processed it, and he's got a plan. And I just like that it's unique, and he's willing to be the salmon. He's willing to swim upstream and do this in a different way.
Well, I liken him to Elon Musk. I think that there's something about his approach where you go, I don't know. You know, but we've seen Elon Musk is a billionaire and has proven everybody wrong, and maybe DeChambeau does that. And you bring up valid points with, you know, he did win at Wingfoot, which is a tough, tough course to win on. Were you guys hanging out in the weight room? Were you spotting him while he was lifting weights?
Protein shakes. I was making protein shakes for him on a regular basis. I'm the shake man. just to interview him and talk to him and just spend a little more time than just, hey, a quick hello on the range. And it was fascinating to see how much he's thought about things. See, I think of you as kind of a DeChambeau and Elon Musk. Go against the grain, do things that others are not expecting, you know, become a billionaire. I think you fit that category as well. Maybe you should connect more with Bryson.
Thank you. I didn't want to say it. I'm glad that you said it. Before I let you go, I've been to Augusta a few times, but if somebody has never been there, like, the first thing that is going to wow them is what?
How beautiful it is. How there's not a piece of trash or a weed growing. There's nothing wrong with anything you see. And then there was someone here, a coworker of mine. I took him down to the ninth fairway, the crosswalk at 9, because you've seen it many, many, many times on TV. But until you go across that crosswalk and you're about 20 yards ahead of where the players hit their second shot, and you look up and all you can see is the front lobe of the green that doesn't hold any shots, that's the one that just sticks with people that, wow, the elevation changes are out of this world. TV cannot and does not do it justice. When they see that, usually the impression is, wow, I never realized that. And those things stick out, I think, more than anything else.
Yeah, I think it's great when you go there, and it's sensory overload. But the one thing that stood out was when you walk that course, that's a workout. Like, you know, you get the feeling, well, it's in Augusta, Georgia, it's got to be flat. There is so much elevation there. That was the biggest surprise. Like, that shot on 18 going up the hill, like, you're going up a mountain there, it feels like at times.
We had a player in the Augusta National Women's Amateur. She was in the bunker. She jumped twice, and her caddy, who's her coach at the University of Houston, said, aim for the top of the TV tower. And she's like, I can't see the top of the TV tower. It gives you a sense. When you were here in the 90s doing SportsCenter stuff, Were you here with Jim Colbert as one of your analysts?
Yes, yes.
I remember that. Gosh, I remember that.
Yes.
Yeah. Jim Colbert.
He would do the whatever that was, like, you know, he would be shooting, yeah. He'd be shooting a gun or saying, yeah.
And he'd do that when he used to make a birdie on the Champions Tour, the Senior Tour, that he'd do that. Yeah, exactly, right? A name came up randomly when I was driving down Washington Road past where you guys used to do the show across from Augusta National.
Yeah. I think it was called the Double Eagle Club.
The Double Eagle. It's still there.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, it's still there.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I don't know if I knew what I was doing back then, but, you know, I was there when Faldo came back and beat Norman. And Rick Riley had the famous quote, because I talked to him on Saturday and I said, what do you think is going to happen? He said, Greg Norman always finds the banana peel. Mm. I'll never forget that. Mm. And then years later, got a chance to sit down with Norman and we revisited that day and what it meant to him and how it impacted him. And, you know, he was a professional in looking back on it. He said, look, I beat myself. Nick didn't beat me. I beat myself. But hey, I'm the one that hit the shots. He was brutally honest with himself. And that's what I love about this sport. Like, you will find guys who will just kind of pour out their emotions and let you know exactly, you know, how this felt. Like Jordan Spieth when he lost the Masters at 12, or Rory when he goes sideways. You get into that press tent and it just feels like it's a confessional for a lot of these guys.
Well, Dan, that's why I've loved my association with golf. And this is now 24 years since I started covering golf on a regular basis. What I love is that it's you and your score into perpetuity. There's no offensive coordinator to blame for a bad play call. You can't say the offensive line was banged up and not protecting me. It's just you. You know, your caddy may hand you a club, but you can always say no. So that's what I love about their honesty. It's refreshing calling rules and infractions on yourself. It is a great game. You have to remind yourself of that sometimes when you try to play it like these guys do, and you realize how good even the lower guys in the tour really are.
Good to talk to you, Mike, as always. Have fun today. We appreciate your time. Safe travels.
Same here. Miss you, bud. Look forward to seeing you soon.
It's Mike Tirico. Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 to noon Eastern, or 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Dan Patrick Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR. Or stream us live on the Peacock app. Let's bring in Tom E. Curran, the Patriots insider working for NBC Sports Boston. Wow, you got a... What kind of shirt you got on there today?
Well, I haven't yet gone to your website to pick up the spare inventory. So I have a nice, I thought Fritzy said it's Loud Golf Shirt Friday.
Yeah.
And apparently I've been duped.
Todd, did you tell Tom? It's not Loud Golf
I may have let him down a dark path and now we could all like kind of humiliate him and laugh at him.
You got catfished by Fritzy.
Not the first.
No. Well, we're glad to have you, Tom. I don't know how New England reacted to Peter Schrager's mock draft yesterday. Peter, of course, works for the NFL Network, and he raised some eyebrows saying the Patriots, he had them moving up to number 4 to take perhaps a quarterback, Justin Fields. Unpatriot-like. What did you make of that?
Yeah, it's unpatriotic, and I don't think that's going to happen. When you look at the amount that San Francisco had to pay to get up to number 3, Patriots are not going to be in the business of giving the 15th and then probably two more first rounders to go up there and get a guy who I thought Mike Lombardi was really good on his podcast this week, explaining why the grades just won't justify it on a Justin Fields or a Trey Lance if those guys are the two remaining. You can't just jump up there and then not have the verbiage, as Lombardi explained it, to say, okay, he grades at this level to be that level pick. He's going to be one of the top 10 players in the league. He makes everyone around him better. He requires more than one player to defend him and take him away. I just don't know if Lance and Fields are going to be those guys.
How involved is Belichick getting – does he ever get impatient? You know, that he's kind of seeing everybody, you know, hey, guys are getting their quarterbacks. I don't really have my quarterback. We spent a lot of money on free agents, but we still don't have a rock-solid quarterback. Is – Bill getting more impatient as he gets older?
I don't think so. I mean, he's been paralyzed since 2017 at the position. They traded Jimmy Garoppolo away, and now all they've done is kind of chase Tom Brady out of town, draft Danny Etling, draft Jarrett Stidham, sign Cam Newton, trade for Brian Hoyer. I mean, if he's impatient, he hasn't signaled it yet. And really, I think Belichick is more hardwired on the draft to kind of scoff at the rest of the league when it gets thirsty and try and be that guy who likes to buy distressed assets. So, you know, sitting at 15, I can see him jumping down, Dan.
But you can do that when you have Tom Brady. But when you don't have Tom Brady, then you can make moves, but it still comes back to, boy, imagine if they had a really good quarterback.
I think that there, however, is some well-founded confidence bordering on arrogance of, look, we had a bad roster last year. We won 7 games with Cam. He didn't have an off season. We had actual tight ends and wide receivers that the Patriots really, and Bill, I don't think, really blames himself for not staffing the rooms, but he ought to. But we add all those players and we get a bunch back on defense and we're better there. You think we're not going to win 11 games? You're out of your mind. We can put anybody back there. And that, to me, is an interesting aspect of the Patriots. Look, yeah, maybe we might have a duct tape answer at quarterback right now, but we're good enough on Sundays and at other positions to mitigate that issue that we absolutely do have.
If a quarterback is there, what are the Patriots, 15th? If a quarterback is there somehow, do you think Bill takes a quarterback?
If he's just sitting there, if Trey Lance is just sitting there, it's got to be hard. It's got to be hard. I mean, when you think of all the players that the Patriots have passed on in the first rounds and later in rounds, second round picks, you know, Lamar Jackson was sitting there at 31. They took Sony Michel. I understand why the Patriots might look at Lamar Jackson and say, look, he's got one indefensible skill in terms of his speed and his electricity as a runner, but we don't know how he projects. And, well, Lamar Jackson's been an MVP. Sony Michel is now going to be a backup running back to Damian Harris. So I think that they probably would pass and take a better player who's been pushed down the board by all those quarterbacks and wide receivers. That's what I think they would do. But I don't know if that's the right thing to do.
And then I wonder, with the Niners going all in on whoever they're going to take at number three, then you got Jimmy Garoppolo there as, you know, in a lame duck season here.
Yeah.
Does Bill, is there part of him that says, I don't need to move up in the draft. I'm eventually going to be trading for Jimmy Garoppolo.
Yeah, I think that he is very much let the game come to him at the quarterback position. I think that is really what they are. Because if you look at Jimmy Garoppolo or Teddy Bridgewater, those guys to me are interchangeable. Yet Bridgewater is actually more durable despite the catastrophic leg injury he had. And he's $8 million a year cheaper. So if you trade for Teddy Bridgewater, which I don't think is going to happen at $17 million, and I don't think that the Patriots are going to trade for Garoppolo at $25 million, but I don't think Garoppolo is going to take a pay cut. So they're pinched in. I would say it's 65 to 75% likely you're going to see either Cam Newton or Jarrett Stidham under center when the season begins. They will add someone, but I don't know if it's going to be anybody we say, oh, that guy's definitely better than Stidham and Newton.
We're talking to Tom Curran, the Patriots insider. Julian Edelman, the knee situation, may not be able to play this upcoming season, which might mark the end of Julian Edelman's career here. How serious is this?
It's serious in that it's not going to be really fixable. You know, he is, last year, the surgery he had was to get him back to where he was in August and early September because it worsened during the year. So he's going to enter the season. Karen Grigian from the Boston Herald reporting that it's unlikely he'll play the full season. And I think that most of us would have taken the under on Julian Edelman at 16 games anyway. But there'll be a point where he says, yeah, okay, I can definitely get open within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage, but can I do anything to make people miss afterwards? Can I protect myself? It'll be interesting to see, because I think the NFL is going to have to be pried from his cold, dead NFL hand before he gives up. And I also think that he is more loyal to the Patriots than other people who would get sideways with Bill and say, I want to go someplace else. So I would be surprised if he doesn't retire a Patriot.
Yeah.
But I also don't think he's going to make a decision before August.
Before I let you go, we were talking about this during the commercial break. Who's the most beloved sports star in Boston or New England history?
History?
Yeah.
I would say Greg Kite.
Okay, that's what I went with.
I don't know.
I think, Bird or Brady, just those two, who's more beloved?
I think Bird probably, or Bobby Orr is probably the most beloved because it's just there's an aura around him. But all of those guys, probably Brady because there's a lot of probably Bird right now because there's a lot of agitation about Brady's departure and the success that he's had. Bird is pretty much bulletproof. Russell, I think, is adored for what he did and what he represents now. I don't think he was so adored in the 70s and 80s. But, yeah, we're freaking lucky. I mean, when you compare Boston to the other towns, maybe that's a good grab-ass story for me on a Friday. Who's got the best array of Mount Rushmore athletes? Who? Dan, who?
Well, we're going to start. Brady's going to be up there. Bird's going to be up there. Is Bird over Bill Russell?
Yeah, I think so. And then, you know, you got Orr.
Baseball player is?
You got Ted Williams or Poppy. So it's a tough array. I mean, you put that up against Colorado. You got John Elway and Andre Scalarraga or Todd Helton.
Okay, but does Southern California, how do you do Los Angeles here?
Well, I mean, who are you going to go with in Southern California? I mean,
well, basketball. LA. I got a variety of guys to pick from.
Kareem. Nobody likes Kareem.
Magic.
All right, Magic.
Kobe.
Okay. All right, Kobe's probably still, but you're going to have to go multiple same sports.
Yeah.
Who are you going to go with for the Kings?
Gretzky.
Oh, it's hard timer.
But he still, that was a huge moment when he got traded from Edmonton. It changed
right.
The NHL.
All right, so.
Baseball, I got Sandy Koufax. How's that?
That's good. Yeah, that's really good.
Now, football.
Ferragamo.
Roman Gabriel.
Eric Dickerson, I guess.
Yeah, huh? I could have Eric in there.
I don't know if you're going to be able to find a better Mount Rushmore than Boston's.
What about New York?
What about it? Willis Reed?
I got Babe Ruth. I got Babe Ruth. Hold on, home slice. I got Joe Namath, and I got Babe Ruth to start out with. Okay,
that's Joe Namath. He threw more picks than touchdowns, man.
Okay, Lawrence Taylor.
Okay, that's better.
Okay, so Walt Frazier?
Better than Brady.
Walt Frazier?
Not Larry Bird.
Okay.
I mean, you could try and appropriate Doc from being in New Jersey.
All right. Maybe it's Boston. Okay.
It is. It's Boston.
But why are you so defensive? I'm just, it's a conversation.
Parochial. We're a parochial area. Yeah, we're a parochial area.
I got your parochial right here.
Tell Fritzy, please, not to do this to me again.
You,
I'm watching
everybody is laughing at you. Everybody.
This is ridiculous.
And you didn't buy that for this appearance. You own that.
Well, I had to fish it out.
But you own that. Did anybody ever tell you you look like the actor Charles from Midnight Run with De Niro?
Charles Grodin. No, I have a very malleable face. I've gotten the Ed Burns guy. I've gotten Drew Brees. I've been messied. I've gotten Al Bundy.
I could see Charles Grodin, Midnight Run with De Niro.
It was a great, great performance.
Yes, it was. It's an unbelievable. I could see Drew Brees there. I see a little bit of that. Like Drew Brees with a really ugly shirt on. I could see it.
Yeah. Hey, you know what, Dan? I said enough of you.
All right, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
I'll see you guys.
Talk to you soon. That's Tom E. Curran.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Dan Patrick Show weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Keith Hernandez, the Mets color analyst for Sports New York, SNY, and former batting champ, a little controversy yesterday. Michael Conforto leaned into a pitch, bases loaded, ninth inning, a walk-off hit by pitch, and Keith kind enough to join us. Walk me through that at bat, Keith. How it started and then how it ended.
Well, there was two strikes, bases loaded, obviously. I forget the count. It might have been
one, two. Yeah.
The pitch was clearly going to be a strike. I did not see – I think Gary Cohn, our play-by-play guy, or Ron Darling, my other analyst in the booth, saw the umpire raising a right hand to make a called third strike. Okay. I noticed – because I'm watching Conforto move his elbow in at the last minute. You can't do that. That's not legal. And it should have been a strike three. Now, the rule, I got sent by Baseball Academy this morning. I'll read you the rule. Mm. But it's a little ambiguous. It's not ambiguous, it's just right to the point. If the ball is in the strike zone when it touches the batter, it shall be called a strike, whether or not the batter tries to avoid the ball. If the ball is outside the strike zone when it touches the batter, it shall be called a ball if he makes no attempt to avoid being touched. But what it doesn't say is, what's the rule about a hitter going in intentionally to get hit, whether it's out of the strike zone or in the strike zone? The pitch was a strike. So by the rule, it clearly should have been a strike three. But besides the point, the big point is you allow all these players with this armor on their elbow. You know, I got hit in my elbow. It's no fun, and it hurts there. And you better put ice on it quick, or it's going to balloon up and you're going to miss a couple games. Fortunately, I had Ron Hunt when I was 19 years old in my first big league camp. He was my roommate, and he taught me to ice it for 24 hours overnight after you got hit on a joint. So you'll play the next day. But with the armor, you're allowing a lot of hitters, and I see it. They don't move. It's very rare if you see someone move into the ball, but they don't move. So the ball's inside 6 and 7 inches. They don't attempt to get out of the way, and that's perfectly legal not to move. But you cannot intentionally go in to get hit by a pitch, and it was very clear on the replay. Now, the second base umpire has the view too, has a good view, the opposite view of the home plate umpire. He could have overruled. Now, I thought Gary Cohn made a great call because we got a list of calls that can be challengeable and what calls can be. Gary knew right away that a hit by pitch is challengeable. But that wasn't the call.
Okay? I know.
Mattingly can challenge. He got hit by a pitch.
Yeah.
But you can't. It's an umpire's judgment where the hitter moved deliberately to get hit. But it was apparent the pitch was a strike. And so the umpire behind the plate, Ron Culpa, blew the call. If he was raising his right arm to call it a strike,
yeah,
then by the rule we just read, that's strike three.
Do you have a problem with what Conforto did?
Yes, I do. I don't. I think you were just talking about back in our day.
But he's helping his team win, though, Keith. Like, whatever it takes. I don't have any problem with it because it's up to the umpire to police the game. Guys cheat all the time.
I understand.
So I don't.
So the umpire blew the call.
Yes, he did.
That would upset a lot of people on the opposing team, and I'm very curious to see Saturday how this unfolds when Conforto gets up the first time. I don't think anything's going to happen. But I know that Steve Carlton told me a great story about Ron Hunt, and you know, he got hit all, he had the body armor, and Carlton said, I was winning 5-6-0 in the eighth inning, and Hunt was leading off, and he said, I know he's going to foul off 8 pitches. So I just hit him on the first pitch and let him go to first base. So I didn't spend any bullets, which I thought was just hilarious.
Yeah.
So,
cause Ron got hit over 200 times in his career. He was the all-time leader. Did Biggio end up passing him?
I don't know.
Or Don Baylor was up there too.
Don got hit a lot also, and there was no body armor in those days for Don. So anyway,
are you okay if the Marlins hit Conforto on Saturday?
Am I okay with it?
Yeah,
I would be okay with it. And we'll see if there's a brawl. You know, I don't know. I'm sure umpires will. I don't know how it's going to happen. I just don't think it's going to happen in today's game. I don't think it's going to happen.
It was wild yesterday because I'm watching and I'm going and I was right there with you and Ron. I didn't know what the rule was. I thought, well, just check replay. And then you could only check replay to see if he got hit. But, you know, Culpa had already made his call. So
he could have been overruled, the second base umpire or the first.
But how much time had to elapse, though, Keith, before he could do it? Because the Mets were celebrating.
They conferred.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the first base umpire is not going to have a view because Conforto's back to him. Second base has the best view, and third base could have made the call as well. But I just think umpires are regulated so much, Dan, and I think that to me, they're looking over their shoulder so much that they are petrified sometimes to make a call because they're observed. And
can
I think
you feed your cat, Keith? What's wrong with
Haji? Haji's the pain in the neck. He's
a Marlins fan. He loves seafood. He loves fish. Yes.
Right. So I just think, you know, it was one time in my career where we had a lot of good umpires in the National League, but we had a handful of bad ones. And they took a poll, and the league decided to take a poll of the players, coaches and managers and rate the umpires. Now, you can have a player or a manager or a coach that has a grudge against a certain umpire, but when you have over 900 players, I think you're going to get a fair assessment of a rating of the umpires. And like any business, there are, if you have an incompetent employee, you get rid of them. Hire competent umpires, and I think there's a lot of them out there, but there's always a scattering of bad ones. Weed them out. And I also feel that you need umpires that have got to have the courage of their convictions. And I think with today's game, with the challenges and the instant replay, number one, it's a crutch for the umpires. You know, if I'm doing my job, I don't want to be overruled. I'd be embarrassed if I made a bad call inconsistently. I would be embarrassed by that, and I would step it up, you know, step up my performance. But I think it becomes a crutch where the umpires, we see it, I just kind of see them getting lazy and say, well, I get it wrong, blah, blah, blah. I don't like that. I don't like challenges too, because we're trying to speed up the game. And the game's become a game of bullpens, and that's why the game has become so long. And you got 8 guys out in bullpens, and you cannot give me eight guys that
just pet them.
You can't give me 8 guys. You can't give me 8 guys that are all going to be great relievers. There's going to be some soft spots, and there's a lot of guys that throw hard that don't have command, and a lot of 3-2 counts. And I understand why the game's become a bullpen game, and that's why the games are longer, because of the pitching changes. So who wants to have the challenge? I mean, I can tell you how many games, Dan, where it's the final play at the plate and the runner's safe and everybody's – and it's challenged and you got to wait, what, 3-4 minutes for the game to be officially over? I just hate that.
It used to be instant replay. Remember when we were growing up? Now it's just replay because it takes forever with replay. We're talking to Keith Hernandez and his cat.
Okay. Haji.
Haji is needy, man.
He's like a dog.
You guys have the same kind of hair color, by the way. Hey, I was talking to Jeff Perlman, and he wrote a book on the 86 Mets. He wrote a book on Showtime Lakers. Showtime Lakers going to HBO, and they're going to make a series out of it. Do you think that they would ever do like a mid-80s Mets, you know, kind of series, like TV series?
Oh, a TV series?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I don't know. I know that ESPN's gonna is doing a big documentary on the 86. I was interviewed two winters ago, and they're doing a 2020 or whatever it is.
30 for 30.
Yeah, they're gonna have a thing on the 86 Mets, which I'm kind of looking forward to.
But you could make a TV series out of the 86 Mets.
You can do it on the Bronx Zoo too in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wasn't around the Bronx Zoo. I was around the 86 Mets, and, man, you guys led the league.
How old are you, Dan? You're my age, aren't you?
Going to be 65.
Yeah, I'm only 2 years older than you.
Yeah, yeah.
You were around. We were aware of what the Bronx Zoo was about.
Yeah, but I wasn't around it. I was around you guys. Like,
so you can draw Social Security now. How about you? Look at you.
I know. I'm getting up there. I got to get me a cat, too. Sure, make that work here. The Mets continue their series against the Marlins tomorrow at Citi Field. Jacob DeGrom, oh, no. He's going to go probably six quality innings, give up one run, four hits, no decision, or lose the game, Keith.
Well, it's incredible that he doesn't get a lot of runs. And it's been kind of like when I was a kid growing up in San Francisco, it was Gaylord Perry. Gaylord Perry was the hard luck pitcher for the Giants. Always lose 2-1, 3-2, lose those close games. And DeGrom has taken it to a new level. I think a lot of it had to do with the COVID outbreak on the Nationals. He was supposed to pitch the real opening day, and he got put back. And they didn't know if they were going to play the next day or the next day, so he couldn't do his sideline. So they made a decision on just six innings. And I disagree. I miss the pitchers going nine innings.
But you get these guys, Nolan Ryan didn't get a lot of support. And they said, well, you know, his players got bored because it was either a strikeout or a walk when Nolan was on the mound. Sid Fernandez, it felt like, had a no hitter through five innings every time I saw him pitch for the Mets. There are just certain pitchers who don't get off. I don't know how you explain it, that they don't get run support.
You know what it was when we were on the road, or it was getaway day? It was like we didn't want Sid pitching getaway day. we wanted Doc out there, get on that airplane and get to the next town.
Sid was going to take forever.
Well, he got a lot of swings and misses.
Oh, he did. He got as many swings and misses as anybody I remember. If you look at, like, per pitch, how many swings and misses? Sid Fernandez got a ton of those, man.
Yes, he had. Well, he had 200 strikeouts, more than a few times in his career. He was, and he was fun to watch pitch because he was just so unusual. His stuff,
his physique.
It doesn't matter. That's the beauty of baseball.
I know. Well, look at Schilling. He had one of the worst bodies, and he was a great pitcher.
And you got, you don't have to be 6'4". You can be like Freddie Patek. We're not being contemporary here.
No.
All the players today are 6'5" and 6'6". I mean, they're just, I'm 6 feet tall, and I feel like I'm dwarfed by them.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, it's great to talk to you. Have fun. My best to Ronnie, and hopefully you have a little bit of drama on Saturday. Not too much drama on Saturday.
Yep.
And
we'll see.
And feed Haji, okay?
I did. I'll feed him again. Just for you.
Thank you, Keith. That's
all right. Good to see you, Dan.
Keith Hernandez. Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 until noon Eastern, 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. And you can find us on the iHeartRadio app at FSR or stream us live on the Peacock app. Let me start with this. I know you're from Ohio, and I'm from Ohio. I went to the University of Dayton, so I wasn't smart enough to get into the school you went into, University of Miami of Ohio, like yourself.
We are the Harvard of the Midwest.
Oh, I know.
So, I mean, I don't mean to brag about it or anything, but you know.
Oh, go figure that you would brag about something there, Ms.
I mean, they did call it J. Crew U. So, I mean, they had any nicknames, the Harvard of the Midwest and J. Crew U were the two that I always went by.
How close did this come to not even happening, this career?
Honestly, it came basically, if I did not get on the Real World, I don't think any of this would have been possible because I think getting on the Real World opened my mind to say, you know what, you could do stuff in the entertainment world. Like, I'm from Parma, Ohio. When you're from Parma, Ohio, you know, you go to college, you get it after college, you go back home, you get a job, you get a family, and that's what you do for the rest of your life. And that's kind of the mode I was in. Like, I went to Miami, Ohio for business, not for entertainment, not for theater. And so if I didn't get on the Real World, I would not be sitting here. I'd probably be working at my dad's Mr. Hero.
How do you find your personality in wrestling?
I think it's time. I think it's confidence. I think it's finding your voice. I think once you find your voice, I think it's like acting. When you're finding a new character, you find the way they walk, the way they talk, how they act, what drives them, what motivates them. And so that's kind of where you start. And then, you know, I've been doing this, The Miz, for 16 years now in WWE. And so it's kind of just second nature for me.
Did you sample from other wrestlers growing up?
I think everyone does. I think that's the when you're first training to be a WWE superstar, they say take from your favorites. So my favorites growing up were like the Ultimate Warrior. Now, granted, I didn't paint my face. I don't paint my face right now. But when I was a kid, you better believe I was painting my face like the Ultimate Warrior and putting streamers on my arm and running around the house annoying my mom. And then like The Rock, Austin, all my favorites, you know, I try to take little samples from them. But also I still want to be my own original character and original Miz. And so I think I've done a good job at a fine line of fine tuning myself and making sure that I give an originality to my character.
Let me give you the power to go back and wrestle anybody one time. Who would it be?
Ultimate Warrior. I never got to wrestle him, and he was my all-time favorite as a kid growing up. I mean, I looked at him, and he was just larger than life and huge and just big personality, big energy. As soon as he came out of the gate, he was running. He had this unbridled like energy that you couldn't match. And I just was so entertained by him.
But do you want to beat your idol? Would you have been okay losing?
Yes, 100%. I would want to beat or get beaten by my idol. either or, it does not matter. I have gotten beaten by like a person that I looked at. I've gotten beaten by The Rock. That was a pretty interesting take. I mean, WrestleMania 27, I'm in the main event of WrestleMania. I'm holding the WWE Championship. I beat the poster child of WWE and John Cena with The Rock's help. And then after that, The Rock rock bottomed me, gave me a people's elbow.
What's the hardest hit you ever got?
The hardest what?
Hit.
Actually, at that WrestleMania, I got tackled off of like a table onto a concrete floor, and my head smacked on the floor, and I could not remember anything. I was knocked out, and yeah, it was insane. It was insane. I think anytime you do anything with your brain, that's one of the that's the hardest thing that you could possibly do.
Explain the art of falling.
The art of falling. Okay, sure. So when you're first learning how to become a WWE superstar or a professional wrestler, you learn how to fall. And the object is to fall flat on your back with your arms flat out. So basically you got to watch your head. And obviously when your arms go flat out, your back muscles kind of tense up. And so it allows your head not to snap. And so I didn't do that time at WrestleMania 27.
You and your wife rehearse things since she's a wrestler?
You know, we rehearse things in the ring, in the bed, whatever we got to do. You know what I mean? So yeah, I mean, we definitely rehearse. My wife is one of the longest reigning champions in WWE history. And she's done a tremendous job with her character and doing her thing in WWE as well. So it's always nice to have your wife. Like when my wife was like kind of like my manager, you know, whenever you have your wife by your side and, you know, the person you love and you're wearing like a Speedo, you kind of want to show off in the ring. And I feel like that was like the best time that I've had as a WWE superstar, because, you know, I was always every week, you know, I show off in front of the audience. But when your wife is standing right there, you know, you give them a little extra.
What do fans say to you when they see you on the street or see you outside of the ring?
I get a lot of yells, a lot of awesome people doing my catchphrases. Correct is my new one. I basically asked John, my tag team partner, John Morrison, a question, and the answer is always correct. And it gets really annoying, but that's my job, to annoy an audience. But the thing is, once something is really annoying, it starts to catch on and you start to do it. And so, yeah, I mean, anytime John asks me a question, it's always correct, correct, correct.
How do you put your game face on? You know, athletes always talk about when you go into the football field or whatever it might be, you got to kind of gear up for that. You're gearing up for something that is competitive. But how do you put that? I'm mad. You know, moments before that you get into character.
I think we have a position called the gorilla position. It's right before we go out. It's where all people are watching the show and telling us how much time there is, you know, what we're going to be doing next. So there's that little area right before we go out to the ramp when our music hits. Usually I'm very nervous. I have butterflies in my stomach. I can't even talk. Sometimes I feel like I'm going to faint. You know, because emotions are running so high, you know, you never know what's going to happen in WWE. It's not like a concert where they play the same song every single day. It's a new match, a new thing going on each and every time. It's a new crowd as well. And our crowd is interactive. They boo who they hate. They cheer who they love. And you never really know what you're going to get. And so when you go out there, you know, you hear the reaction. And once I hear that reaction, all of those nerves go away and it turns into this immense amount of energy, adrenaline, and I feed off of it. And I really enjoy it. And now with WrestleMania coming up on Saturday and Sunday, you know, it's the first time we've had a live audience in over a year.
Yeah.
So I cannot wait to feel the electricity of that audience, to feel that energy. Now, granted, WWE's did a great job with the virtual audience. You know, we have a virtual crowd in a place we called the Thunderdome, and they've done a great job in making it feel like a live audience, but having the real life human beings in that crowd, it's going to be amazing.
And you're working with Snickers.
Yeah.
Their role in this is what?
So WrestleMania is presented by Snickers, and at Dollar General, you can get my Snickers bar, which I think is incredible. It says awesome on it. My catchphrase is I'm the Miz and I'm awesome. So you can go to Dollar General and you can get a candy bar that says awesome on it. And it's dedicated to me. And I cannot believe, like, never in my wildest dreams when I was growing up as a kid, you know, going to convenience and getting myself a Snickers bar, did I ever think a Snickers bar would be dedicated to me? So it's pretty incredible, and I'm always very thankful for all the opportunities I'm presented, and I'm just very thankful. You know, I love Snickers, and they do a great job, and I got my own Snickers bar. It's kind of cool.
When's the last time you had a wardrobe malfunction?
Ooh, I haven't had very serious wardrobe malfunctions, but I have seen a person. So one of the things a bad guy will do is grab the tights because it's illegal, and throw a person because it's easier to throw a person when you grab onto their clothes. One time a guy grabbed onto the person's Speedo or tights, as we call them. He ripped them off. He didn't, like, they just came right off. And the guy was just standing there butt naked. And you hear the crowd, and it's live, by the way. You don't get two takes. So you hear the crowd just go absolute silence, and you hear one lady go, and then everyone else starts erupting. But this poor guy was just whole, and the other guy that was wrestling him had no idea that the guy was naked, like, had no idea. And I don't know how he didn't know, but he didn't know.
I'm guessing the woman who's laughing, that's not a good thing if you're the guy
that's
who's naked.
That's not a good sign when a woman is laughing in the crowd.
So what happens to Bad Bunny this weekend at WrestleMania?
I feel sorry for him because, you know, I don't feel sorry for him. I feel sorry for his fans because they're probably not going to hear him sing in probably a good year because that's the amount of time it's going to take for the wire out of his jaw to come out from when I'm done punching him.
Wow.
So, but yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, he came for a performance and he overstayed his welcome and he beat down the wrong door. And now, no matter how many times he has, I mean, honestly, Bad Bunny is one of the biggest recording artists out there right now. He just won a Grammy. He has over a billion views on all his videos in YouTube. Like just one of his video has a billion views, like that's not a million, that's a billion. So the guy is wildly famous, has a huge fan base, but he doesn't understand that at WrestleMania, this is our Super Bowl, our World Series, our NBA Finals. And we honestly feel it's bigger than that. It's the greatest spectacle you will ever see. And you'll take away moments that'll last a lifetime. It's just the sad part is that Bad Bunny's fans are going to take away a moment that they're not going to want to see. And he's not going to want to feel because I am one of the best of all time. I'm the only two-time Grand Slam champion in the history of WWE. And I plan on showcasing that at WrestleMania.
He's the greatest wrestler ever from the University of Miami, or Miami University. You are the best wrestler to ever come out of there. Is that correct?
You know, I would say so. I would say I'm almost the one of the most famous people ever to come out of Miami University of Ohio. But, you know, it all depends on what sport you like. Like some people like basketball, where they'll say Wally Szczerbiak is. Some people like football, where they say Ben Roethlisberger is. You know, I like to pat myself on the back and say, well, I'm the biggest.
I'm waiting for the Broadway musical Les Mis.
Aren't we all? You know, I'm waiting for them to give me a call and maybe I can go over there. And since I am the Miz, be Les Mis for once.
Mike, thanks for getting up with us and have fun this weekend. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Yeah, definitely tune in to WrestleMania as presented by Snickers Saturday, Sunday, April 10th and 11th. And if you want to, April 12th is Monday. And my show, my reality show, Miz and Mrs., is coming back with all new episodes on the USA Network at 11 p.m. You're not going to want to miss it. It's a family-friendly show. It'll make you laugh out loud, and it's fun. It's entertaining. So thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Miz.
Have a good one.
That's The Miz. He's wrestling Bad Bunny coming up on Saturday night on Peacock.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.